Well, welcome. This is our 10th session of our study on Israel, the Arabs, and Islam. And I want to pick up near to where we left off last week. And I've placed a whole series of maps in the components of our study for this evening. And the first one shows the territory that the Ottoman Turks, the last of the caliphates, had in the Holy Land, in Israel, just on the eve of World War I. And they entered the war as an ally to Germany. I didn't know that last week, but I looked it up, and they did. They entered, the Ottoman Turks entered World War I as an ally to Germany. It's interesting the way the literature will describe this. They describe it as they were going to fight against people. They didn't say that they were with the Germans, but they ended up being with the Germans. They ended up as an ally to the Germans because they were against several other countries that the Germans were fighting. And in October of 1914, Generalissimo Djemal Pasha, he was an Ottoman general in the Syrian army, he issued this proclamation, which included the conscripting of all the Jews and Christians in the Ottoman Empire to come in and fight for the Turks. And one of the things that he did was severely punish anybody that supported the Jewish national cause, because there were Jews living in Palestine and within that caliphate. He punished anybody that flew the Jewish flag, the Star of David, and he disarmed the Jewish defense forces that had been formed and previously sanctioned by the Ottomans to protect themselves, so that they could protect themselves from marauders. And what this ended up doing was it allowed the Arab marauders free access to the Jews. So they started coming back and harming the Jews. He closed down an Anglo-Palestine bank that was a primary source of funding for the Jews in Israel. So they lost a lot of their business financing. And they scoured the Jews' provisions, and they took their food away, and any provisions that they had, any military provisions they had, they just took them all away from them. And then they cut down the trees. It was a forest of eucalyptus trees that they cut down in an area called Shadera, and those trees were planted about 40 years earlier to soak up the swamps that were producing malaria. And as a result, the malaria went away. The Jews figured out if you plant these eucalyptus trees where all these swamps are, the eucalyptus love that water, and it got rid of the malaria. Well, this was allowing the malaria to come back when they did this. British forces were fighting against the Turks, and they prevailed. And when they closed in on the Turks, in Baghdad, the Turks arrested a bunch of Jews and tortured them because they said they were supporting the Brits. 18,000 Jews there were conscripted into the Turkish army, and they were required to support and fight under that crescent moon flag. About 1,000 of them died in action in Baghdad. And General Allenby's victory parade came into Jerusalem in December of 1917. There's a typo in the last set of notes. You might want to correct that. I had 1914 down. It's actually 1917. 1914 is when the war started. The British officially took control over what they were calling Palestine at the time, and we call it Israel. And they were exerting all the influence, and they had complete control of it, and they were exerting the influence over that region. Fortunately, they were tolerant and even in love with the Jews. They were trying to get the Jews a natural homeland. Allenby remarked that the wars of the Crusades are now complete. We've taken this back from Islam. It was a moral victory for the Brits and the Jews as well, and his Allenby's march into Jerusalem there, that I got a picture of it there from 1917, it really marked a ceremonial end of that Ottoman Empire. So if we had to pick a date for the actual end of that caliphate, it would be December of 1917. And I think we spoke a little bit on our last session about the Paris Peace Conference that happened in the early 1920s and how chaotic that was. All the nations wanted to persecute Germany unreasonably. They wanted to take away all of their production facilities, and then they wanted to force them to pay zillions of dollars in Deutschmarks. And, you know, it was unreasonable. They wanted to hurt them so bad that none of the goals that they wanted to achieve were ever going to be reasonable. And what that resulted in Germany self-inflating their money. So they inflated their money supply so badly that they paid back the Allies in dollar or Deutschmarks that were just worthless. But, you know, they had no production facilities, and it wasn't until 1933 when Hitler came to power that they actually started violating the Paris Peace Conference and producing armaments and bringing Germany back. That's when they developed the Volkswagen and the Autobahn and so on. This was all in violation of the Paris Peace Conference, but nobody stopped them. That's the interesting thing about tyrants. Nobody stops them until they have wreaked havoc with society. People let them go. There are so many people that just want to take the ostrich effect and put their head in the sand and say, it's not happening. I don't want it to happen. I know nice people over, so on and so forth. And then the despots just get complete control, ruin everything before somebody finally steps up and does something about it. The area that the Paris Peace Conference gave to the Brits in Israel was called Palestine, and they called the British control over it the British Mandate. Now, that British Mandate referred to a specific geographic region, and we're going to look at the next map shows that mandate. But before we get there, I just wanted you to realize that it was Great Britain that took control, Great Britain that designed this, Great Britain that wanted the Jews to go back, Great Britain that had written the Balfour Declaration and had worked really hard for the last 50 years or so in what was called the Zionist movement to bring the Jews back to a homeland. They need a homeland. They're scattered all around the world. Winston Churchill was the guy that wrote the British Mandate. That was his document. He referred to the Jews' entrance back into Israel as a natural right. They belong there. We got to work to get them there. And when he did this, there was a mass migration that happened, not by today's standards, but by, you know, World War I standards. You got to remember, there was less than 100 million people in our country at the time. There's three times that now. So a mass migration just meant with the world Jewry, you know, there was a lot of them from the Middle East and Europe that were moving there because they really thought they were going to have a homeland. That was going to be this British mandate. But under the terms of the mandate, Britain had to implement what was called the Balfour Declaration, and that was to give the Jews a homeland. And that declaration basically established a national home for the Jews. Initially, there weren't going to be any territorial restrictions, either the east or the west of the Jordan River. And they were looking at the Bible to see what was the dimensions that had been given in the book of Genesis for the national homeland for the Jews. The mandate stipulated that Britain was to facilitate immigration but not control it. And there was a whole lot of problems within the British government on trying to do this. As you can imagine, just what we see in the paper about any governmental body trying to decide anything. There was a lot of problems, but they ended up doing this, and the Jews ended up getting a substantial portion of the land there. Now, the next map shows you what that division was between 1922 and 1946, and the pink area was what the Jewish national homeland was supposed to be, called the British Mandate. The line that runs vertically through the Sea of Galilee and through the Salt Sea and down into the Sinai was a division that put it into two administrative districts. They had a lot of political fights with the Arabs. the Arabs wanted part of this, and everybody was trying to give the Jews part of it. So to the east, it became known as Transjordan. And the Brits put this Hashemite guy there who came from Arabia. His name is Abdullah. And it ended up, after they went through all these arguments, that only 22% of that original territory was given to the Jews. And the mass migration came about, and even though they were persecuted by the Arabs and the Muslims in the surrounding countries, they still came in. In 1923, one group, there was several hundred Jewish orphans that came from Hodeida, they were forced to convert to Islam. And there was one Arab emir who actually fought against the Ottoman Turkish rule. His name was Faisal. And Faisal and his successors are in Saudi Arabia now. The monarchy in Saudi Arabia came from Faisal. And that's why the Arabs in Saudi Arabia are more tolerant toward the Jews than other Arab countries are now. Even though that's the home of Islam, they are more tolerant. They sell oil to us and so on, and they're much, much more tolerant. Faisal actually welcomed the Jews into Israel. He signed an agreement with Chaim Weizmann, who became the future president of Israel. Weizmann was also a guy that he developed acetone and some military weaponry for the Brits in World War I. He's the exception, though. Faisal's exception, because there's still much opposition in the Muslim communities towards the Jews. there was one guy named Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was in Islamic terms, the Mufti of Jerusalem in 1922. He hated the Jews as much as anybody could. He aligned himself with Hitler during Hitler's reign, tried as hard as he could to bring Hitler down there to persecute the Jews in Arabia. He just claimed, you know, he would lie and claim that the Jews want to take away the Muslims' holy places and so on. And in 1929, he turned his followers against the Jews in a savage attack, because that's what they can do. You see, they can incite people to rioting and attacking by lying and then pumping up the rhetoric and getting people all excited about this stuff. It ended up killing 40-some Jews, and there were about 4,000 of them that were left homeless, and their residences were looted by the Muslims. But nevertheless, even though these types of things were happening, even as we saw under the caliphates, there were some prosperity for the Jews. There was a good life in the 20s. For example, the liberal Muslim, the Shah of Iran, was very, very helpful to the Jews. He didn't persecute them. And he was very, very liberal. You know, he was a Muslim in name only. That was not a heavy, heavy Muslim country at that time. It sure is different now, you know, since the Shah was deposed in the late 70s and the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini came in, what a sick guy he was, and took over. And that's the regime that's over there now. At that time in the 1920s is when the Muslim Brotherhood was formed. And they had written and were conducting debates in the Middle East on a topic that was in the press called the subject of Palestine and the necessity of jihad. They have, since their foundation, implored a hatred for the Jews, no matter what country they're in. They haven't said that we just want them out of Israel. No, they just don't want the Jews to exist at all, and they're trying to persecute them wherever they are. Many Muslims during this period wanted to claim sovereignty to the Middle East, especially that little piece of land there that the British mandate had given to the Jews, and continued to control the Jews as dhimmi. In other words, the people that are under the thumb of Islam and forced them to convert to Islam. And their target at that time, because they didn't have an international presence, they didn't have an international ability to do this, but their targets were the the orphans, the Jewish orphans. And they were going into the orphanages and taking them and trying to convert them. So we just see that during this period, there was toleration in some aspects and there was animosity towards the Jews and others. The part of Transjordan that became Arab, the part of the mandate is Transjordan, and the name was changed to Jordan. So that division widened, if you will, and it became an independent country. The mandate, though, at that time, it was treated like it was its own country. It had its own little constitution. It had its own money. And there were Jews and Arabs in the mandate that were issued passports with the mandate. So they could travel, but they had, in essence, a country that had a passport. So the British mandate was actually a country, if you will. And in 1946, that was when Great Britain gave Transjordan independent status. And they changed the name, the Transjordan changed the name to Jordan. And Article 7 of the mandate stipulated that the acquisition of Palestinian citizenship by Jews who take up their permanent residence in Palestine. In other words, the Jews can have residence there if they're, you know, and they can't be persecuted in essence. The Jews want to live on the east side of the Jordan River, they can do so. That's the way it was set up at the time. Then comes the United Nations partition plan. The United Nations, at the end of the war, had the world sympathy on its back regarding the Jews because of what Hitler did. And we all know that he exterminated millions of them and millions of them in those ovens. He killed them and slaughtered them and burned them. He set up an industrial genocide. Well, once that was revealed to the world, then there was a great deal of sympathy that the Jews had to have their own national country, not just under the Brits as a mandate, but a real country all their own. And at that time, 1947, the UN came up with a plan, and that map there that shows what their territory is depicts the blue as the Jewish state, which is not very much. It's only 8 or 9 miles wide at its narrowest spot there. The Arabs were going to get the what was called at that time and now the West Bank, which is really Judea and Samaria, and the Gaza Strip. And then there would be an international zone, which is really hard to see on this map, but it's really teeny for some international forces to be there to keep the peace. On November the 29th, 1947, the UN General Assembly voted to do this. There was a two-thirds majority of the world's leaders in that assembly that voted for giving a Jewish and Arab state in what was called Palestine. And most of the land that the Jews got was desert. It just wasn't even usable. But that's the only thing that they could negotiate with the Arabs. They didn't give them anything good. And the Jewish population accepted the plan, and we all know that they turned it into an absolute gold mine. They set up irrigation systems and kibbutzes, and they developed industry and cities, and they're just brilliant in what they did. God's with them. God wants them to thrive. And the Arabs tried as hard as they could to stop everything that the Jews did. All the Arab member states of the UN, Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen, they voted against this. They were in the one-third. They didn't want the Jews to have this. But the resolution was adopted, and the New York Times says in 1947 on December the 1st that the Arab governments declared their opposition to this partition in a very, very meaningful way. Now, there's the land of Israel on the next full-page map, and that shows you what there was given to them on the eve of the War of Independence. Because just because the UN gave them that property doesn't mean that they were going to have an easy time of acquiring it. The tan area is what Israel had. Everything else belonged to the Arabs. And in 1948, five Arab armies, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, immediately invaded Israel after Ben-Gurion declared Israel a state. May the 15th, 1948, within a couple of days, the Arabs invaded. The stated purpose of the invasion was to push the Jews into the sea, and Hassan Pasha, who was Secretary General of the Arab League, said, and I quote, "This will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades. What Hitler didn't finish 3 years earlier, the Arabs would finish once and for all." And the guy that we just mentioned a few moments ago, Haj Amin al-Husseini, he was charged at the Nuremberg trials for trying to kill, you know, genocide, get active in the genocide of Hitler. He escaped. I don't know where he went to, but he escaped, and he never did get tried. But he actively supported Hitler and his efforts to exterminate the Jews in World War II. Despite the disadvantages, despite the fact they had no weapons other than Czechoslovakian World War I weapons, they had hardly anything, no tanks, hardly any airplanes. The Haganah captured several major towns. They got Tiberias and Haifa, and they temporarily opened the road to Jerusalem as well. And again, I said Czechoslovakia was the only country that was willing to help them. The Brits didn't even help them. The United States didn't help them. Nobody did. Everybody just sat back and watched. And maybe that was part of God's plan, to let the world see that he is driving the Jews. He's allowing them to come back, and he's going to give them the victory because nobody helped them. It's not like they had a massive amount of allies that were helping them. God wanted them to survive. And the Jordan captured the West Bank, which we call Judea and Samaria, and they got half of Jerusalem. The Jews only had half of Jerusalem. Egypt got what was called the Gaza Strip. They took control of that and the Sinai. And as we've seen in other studies, this was the ancient land of the Philistines. The Gaza is the ancient land of the Philistines with their five cities there. Both countries, Jordan and Egypt, expelled or murdered every Jew that they could get a hold of that was living in their countries, the Gaza and Judea and Samaria. They killed them all, just slaughtered them, and they started calling those regions the occupied territory. Neither country was willing to create an independent state for the Arabs. You have to understand this. These Arab countries wanted to keep the Arabs that were in the Gaza Strip and in the Judea and Samaria. They wanted to keep them there. The Jews offered them to come into their country. Come on in. You can be citizens here. They didn't want to. They wanted to stay Arab. They said, okay. The Arabs wouldn't let them in. They wouldn't let them into their country. So they stuck here in these spots. And they didn't have any means of production. They didn't have any skills. So they ended up going into internment camps in these areas. And it was terrible. During the 19 years that Jordan and Egypt occupied these territories, they wouldn't help any of their own people at all. It's like they just wanted to create that pressure cooker. And in 19 years, you can only imagine how many kids are going to be born in those communities, hating the Jews. Everybody blamed everything on the Jews when it's really the Arabs that wouldn't let them in. The Arabs wouldn't let them in. And any of the so-called Palestinians that were in that region just desecrated the Jewish graves from that area. And they used graves, the Jewish gravestones, to pave roads and build latrines. The Jewish homes that were there, they were given to the Arabs. Most of the Jewish refugees that were there got out and went to Israel. In a couple of years, Israel's population doubled. The Ashkenazi Jews of Israel absorbed Arab-speaking brethren that wanted to come in into their society. And you can look at the Knesset today. There are Arab Muslims that are in the Knesset. Israel is a democracy. It's willing to bring these other people in. The Arabs are not. The Arabs don't want anything to do with anybody else. And if you even think about converting to one other religion, they'll kill you. So there's no love lost between these folks here. There was no policy of expelling any Arabs from Islam. In 1949, Israel signed an armistice with these other countries because they beat the pants off of them. I mean, it was just a disgusting display of power that the Jews had against the Arabs. The Arabs just didn't have anything. I should say the Arabs had a disgusting display of vulnerability because they weren't very good. And the Jews were out. They outwitted them. They out militarily strategized and won against the Arabs in that War of Independence. It was a whole lot of Jewish villages destroyed and burned, and the Jewish quarter, the old city of Jerusalem, was besieged and was kept without food or water. And eventually the Jordanians got out of the old city, and they took over to East Jerusalem, which we will see in a future message that the Israelis got it back. And it's interesting, as the map shows you, that Jerusalem, or Israel at its narrowest point, is only 9 miles wide. Now you can see how vulnerable they are. 9 miles is all they have. And God wanted them to survive, despite an incredible amount of loss. God wanted them to survive, and with incredible odds, hardly any armaments, and God brought them back into that homeland. He wanted to see his prophecies fulfilled. And what God does these things so that the world can see that God is there and he's in control. Just like he said he's going to do when the Russians and the Muslim nations invade Israel. He's doing this for his glory, to let Israel beat them all. And when that invasion happens, there won't be any Muslim left alive, and every Jew will be alive. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing to see this happen. So there you have that, another segment of what has happened and what is going to happen.